We're going to go on then to our second case of the day, which is Appeal 054410, and it is Mudrin v. Brown & Brown, Incorporated. Good morning, Ms. Major.
May it please the Court. Good morning. My name is Ruth Major, and I am counsel for Appellant Patrick Mudrin. This is an appeal by a plaintiff in an employment discrimination case that was brought under the Age Discrimination and Employment Act. Mr. Mudrin, at the time he was terminated from his position with the defendant, was 54 years old, and he had been employed by the defendant company in one form or another. The company was acquired just before his termination, but he'd been employed for 25 years with this small group in the Joliet, Illinois area. The basis of our appeal is that there were several decisions that were made by the trial court that led to the trial judge granting summary judgment in favor of the defendants. The first two decisions that we address in our briefs and that we'll be addressing have to do with the exclusion of expert reports that were submitted by Mr. Mudrin through the discovery process. The second issue has to do with how the court handled the motion for summary judgment that was filed in this case by defendants. This court and the United States Supreme Court have repeatedly cautioned trial courts that they should not too readily grant summary judgment when acts are susceptible to two interpretations and should not dismiss as irrelevant damaging statements that are made by defendants. In this case, at every opportunity in reviewing the summary judgment motion, the evidence was viewed in favor of the moving party, the defendant, instead of the plaintiff, the non-moving party, contrary to the principles of this court and the law of this court and the Supreme Court. Inferences were drawn in favor of the defendant. Statements were interpreted in a way favorable to the defendant, and credibility assessments, which shouldn't even be made on a summary judgment, were made in favor of the defendant. There are numerous instances throughout the record that establish this, and I'll go through some of these today, but many of them are set forth in the brief. As a result of these decisions by the trial judge, my client was not able to present his case and to present his witnesses and his evidence to a jury to let them decide who they believed and what inferences should be drawn from the evidence. He never had his day in court and his opportunity to have a jury of his peers make those determinations. This case, there's many facts in the facts section, but briefly, he worked for 25 years and had an exemplary record. There's testimony by John Manner, who was the person who ran the agency for 25 years, that he was his most valued employee, other than perhaps his son-in-law. And
how long was he kept on after the merger of these two companies?
The companies merged in September of 2002. In April of 2003, he was terminated. So it was approximately 8 months. At the time of his termination, his testimony is he never had any warnings of problems. They never discussed any problems with him. And in fact, there's no documents whatsoever in his personnel record of any problems. He was the same performer and the same person before the merger as he was after the merger. The only difference from the evidence that we've seen is that there was this Brown & Brown entity that was now directing how things should be handled.
And were other people released at the same time?
There were, at the office, there were some support staff and that type of thing. There were only four producers that were working at that office. Those are agents generating insurance business. Only two were over 40. Both were terminated at the same time, Mr. Mudrin and another employee, Mr. Fitro.
In the total group of the people released, how many were over 40?
Both.
Oh, they released more than just those two.
Well, They released some. I don't know actually.
They were downsizing.
They were not downsizing because at the same time they were bringing other people in.
You mean from their other company, the merger?
Well, there's never been anything said that this was the result of downsizing. That's never been an explanation that was given, Your Honor. They gave as their reason.
My curiosity piques me as to the age of the people being released. That's all.
Well, we've only focused on people that were similarly situated to Mr. Mudgeron, and there were two. There were four total producers. There were two from this office that were released. They were both in their mid-50s to late 50s. They were older gentlemen.
Was the claim that they were redundant or that their work was unsatisfactory?
That their work was unsatisfactory. Mm. And those are reasons which...
That has to do with the new boss, huh?
Well, what they're trying to say is that it was made by the same person. The decision was made by the same person who had been supervising Mr. Mudgeron for 25 years. 25 years of acceptable performance, and all of a sudden, if you read the record and you believe what the defendant is saying, which we dispute on every count, he became a complete mess in an eight-month period. He went from being a respected, hardworking, valued employee to being somebody that nobody would want working for them. And he denies that he did these things. He's testified under oath, and he's provided affidavits and answers to discovery requests saying he didn't do these things. He didn't say these things. He didn't...
There's some dispute, I gather, as to who made this decision, whether it was Manor or the other fellow who was...
That is another point, Your Honor. There is a dispute as to who made the decision. At one point, they said it was Wagner was the final decision maker. At another point, they said it was Manor. There's testimony that Hyatt Brown was involved in the decision-making process, that he met and it was discussed with him. Then there's denials of that as well. The evidence that we presented on this issue, on the issue of the termination, included the changing reasons for the termination. When he was first terminated, he was told something to the effect that it's not working out. That was all he was told. In his personnel file, the documents that were put in there at the time of his termination listed one reason, performance. Okay, and one of the forms had a number of different options that could have been listed, including insubordination and improper conduct, that type of thing. None of those were listed. When the case got to the EEOC, the defendant had all sorts of different other reasons that they were adding to why he was terminated. At the EEOC, for the first time, he was accused of bad-mouthing Brown & Brown. He closed his door. He had secret meetings. He was doing all kinds of things, making racial comments, making religious comments. None of these things had ever been brought to his attention, and they admit that. And he denies he ever did it. They also, during the course of this case, as their reasons progressed, they started making statements that he was trying to solicit employees from Brown & Brown before he was terminated.
Let me ask you something about the separate employment agreement between Mr. Mudgeron and Brown & Brown. Is it your position that although there was this separate employment agreement, which said that he was terminable at will, is it your position that the validation schedule somehow modified the terms of that employment agreement?
It is our position that the understanding of the parties and the way the parties acted after the validation schedule was entered was that the validation schedule was what was controlling the relationship in terms of production and in terms of Mr. Mudgeron's expectations as to how he would be treated. And if you look at now, defendant has tried to say repeatedly, this is just a compensation schedule. But if you look at it, it states in there that he will be given 2 quarters to make these goals. And it also states in there that once 2 quarters go by, then there's 2 different choices. That sets a very clear course of conduct for the defendant in the event that these goals aren't being met. The defendant wants to use the validation agreement schedule to say he wasn't performing well. They want to use it to their benefit. But when there's parts of it that go against what they did, when there's evidence that they acted inconsistent with it, they want to say, well, those parts don't apply. Don't pay any attention to that. Look at the employment agreement. You can't have it both ways. If you're going to say that the validation agreement governed this employment relationship, which is our position and which was Mr. Mudgeon's understanding, and that's his testimony, then you have to take the good with the bad if you're the defendant. And the bad is they did not act consistent with their own validation schedule. They terminated him contrary to the terms that they themselves had set up. They never gave him that time to meet his goals. There's also disputed testimony about whether or not he was on track to meet those goals. He said he had work in the pipeline, and before he could bring it all in and meet that quota, he was terminated, prematurely terminated. That's another disputed issue. Now, they have claimed that they didn't think he could make it. That's where they go. They understand, okay, we're right. He can show that he would have made it. So then they say, well, we didn't think he could make it. So after 25 years, they're trying to say that they just decided to terminate him because they've all of a sudden decided he can't meet his goals. But there's testimony from Mr. Mudgeon that the person who says that he didn't think he could make it also said to him that he didn't think he could make it because of his age. And that ties in this belief that there was a discrimination and different treatment of Mr. Mudgeon because of his age to the decision to terminate him, if in fact that was really why they terminated him.
Give me the words that were used, that you allege were used, regarding his age.
I believe we quoted them in our brief, and I can bring that to you in rebuttal when I have a chance to look at the exact words. Oh. But it was something to the effect that they didn't expect that at his age he'd be able to meet his quota. That was the comment that Mr. Manor had made to Mr. Mudgeon earlier on before he was terminated. And then that is exactly the reason that they're claiming they terminated him, because they didn't expect him to meet his quota.
Don't spend your time looking for that. Listen to your...
Okay. The other issues with regard to the termination, then I'll just get to the expert reports.
We're in your rebuttal time. You know this.
I did not realize that.
The light is on.
Oh, okay. I apologize. Let me just go quickly through this, and then I'll get back, and then I'll save some time for rebuttal. We presented statistical evidence. The reports were excluding with no finding of prejudice. The court didn't follow this court's directives on how to analyze whether there's prejudice or unfair surprise or that type of thing. We also presented evidence of another office where the defendant was trying to hide information about terminations of some older workers as well.
Well, I take it you would agree that there were certain errors and shortcomings in Dr. Moose's report.
There was a classification error. She had grouped people who retired into involuntary terminations.
Well, right.
That didn't affect the entire report. It affected part of it.
Well, but why couldn't the judge conclude that if the original report includes voluntary terminations, that's not a reliable analysis of whether a company's involuntary terminations reflect a discriminatory pattern?
Our position is that it didn't call for exclusion of the report. It goes to the probative value and the weight that should be given to those certain aspects of the report. And the court could have said, given that error, I'm not going to consider it. But what happened here was, without any finding of prejudice, without any claim of prejudice, a second report which corrected whatever errors were in the first report was rejected by the court. And the result was dismissal.
It was rejected because it was untimely, isn't that true?
Well, it was. There's some. If you look at the record, there's some issues about the timeliness. On the date that discovery closed, we asked for a chance to respond to the motion to strike, and at that time, the court gave us the opportunity to do that. And I see my time has run up. I was answering your questions, but I would like a chance to finish that thought. If I may.
Ed, I'll give you a minute that you don't really have for rebuttal.
Okay, I appreciate it. Just on that thought, there was no prejudice to the defendant. The defendant The defendant's expert had the name of our expert, had his report, had his analysis, and before the deadline passed, the defendant's expert even had addressed the errors in our report. And the things that were included in the supplemental report were just responding and supplementing the report to address what their expert had raised. It was brought to the court and filed before the motions were even filed. The motion for summary judgment hadn't even been filed when that supplemental report was given to the defendant. It was addressed. The defendant's expert even addressed that report in his own report that he subsequently filed with the court. And there was not a trial or a pretrial date set yet in this case. So there was just no prejudice. And that's what the Seventh Circuit said in the Sherrod case, that you have to have some prejudice. And that's what the federal rules, so that justice can be furthered by these rules. So thank you.
Okay. Ms. Ramsey?
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. Good morning. Not surprisingly, I'm here to argue that the district court got it right when granting the motion to strike the expert report and subsequently granting the motion for summary judgment. A point of fact that I'd like to clarify, on which the record is clear, Mr. Mudrin wasn't a 25-year employee of Brown & Brown. Brown & Brown acquired the prior employer, John Manor Insurance Agency, and with that came an entirely new employment relationship. Mr. Mudrin could have chosen not to join Brown & Brown, but he chose to do so. And in doing so, the relationship was completely different, most importantly with respect to how commissions were paid. At Brown & Brown, Mr. Mudrin earned 50% commission on new business and 50% commission on renewal business. Brown & Brown paid substantially less, 40% on new business and 20% on renewal. And in order to bridge the gap and help producers who joined Brown & Brown earn the same amount of money that they were earning at their prior employers, this validation schedule was created. It just established a series of sales goals that a producer needed to meet in order to eventually stand on his own 2 feet and work off straight commission.
Mr. Brown made a pretty strong statement that he preferred younger employees. It's quoted in the briefs. Is it just a coincidence that the two people, producers, let go in these this office at very short notice? It seems to me we're in the older age group.
Well, I'll address the I think 2 points you made there, Your Honor. First, Mr. Brown's statement related to his recruiting practices, and it was misquoted in the brief. The brief quoted it as, "We like to have young people." Mr. Brown said, "We like to hire young people into the audit department," which is separate from producers, "because those are the employees whose salary we can afford." This has nothing to do with Mr. Mudrin and nothing to do with Mr. Mudrin's termination.
When you say that, I know you want to answer the second part of the question, but when you say that was misquoted, is that an absolute fact? Is that a contested fact?
Oh, it's an absolute fact that the way that plaintiff's counsel described the quote in the brief is not how it reads in the record. Mr. Brown.
That's what I was. That was a question I was trying to get at earlier.
That it's in the briefs, and Your Honor will find that there. The second question relates to the termination of another producer over age 50 by the name of Mike Fitro. The record shows that Mr. Fitro wasn't terminated necessarily for performance reasons, because although he was a JMI employee prior to Brown & Brown, he wasn't a salesperson. He used to be a salaried employee who managed accounts. As a producer, he was having some performance difficulties, but the problem and the reason that Mr. Fitcher was terminated is because another producer told Brent Wagner and John Manor that Mr. Fitro and Mr. Mudrin were having discussions about joining a rival insurance agency. And that caused some concern to Mr. Wagner and Mr. Manor because they were afraid that they would sabotage the agency. They confronted Mr. Fitro about his plans to stay with Brown & Brown, and he couldn't commit to doing so, so they let him go.
Well, of course, the problem with all that is the chicken and the egg. I mean, they were sort of under surveillance, I guess, is should they be retained or should they be fired? And one would expect under those circumstances they might be exploring other opportunities for employment.
Correct, but the concern was...
You can't blame them for wanting a job, you know.
Well, certainly not, but the report that another producer, Larry Jungles, gave to his managers at Brown & Brown was that these appeared to be secretive meetings, and that, plus a lot of other very negative comments that Mr. Mudrin had made about Brown & Brown, led them to believe that he didn't have Brown & Brown's best interest at heart, so that he not only intended to leave, but also to sabotage the company on his way out.
Speaking of Mr. Jungles, Mr. Mudrin suggests in his reply brief, and again today, that if he had been credited for the sales that were consummated after his termination, his numbers would have been comparable to those of Mr. Jungles. So I'd like a response to that.
Well, what's an interesting point that counsel made during argument is the accusation that Brown & Brown's trying to have it both ways with the validation schedule. The validation agreement says very specifically that only certain kinds of sales qualify for validation. A lot of what Mr. Mudrin claims to have done is renewed his book of business. The validation schedule clearly states that renewal business doesn't count. And then secondly, he only... accounts that generate $1,000 or more per month in commissions qualify. So none of those would have qualified either. I think what your Honor's referring to is his claim that he sold a very large life insurance policy. That was a client of Mr. Manners, and any much like origination credit in law firms, Mr. Mudrin couldn't have sold something to somebody else's client and taken the credit for it. The record is clear that that's not how it worked at Brown & Brown.
Even if the original seller had nothing to do with the second policy?
That's correct.
Wow.
And Mr. Manner didn't give permission for him to sell that policy. There were, other than performance was only one small reason among many for Mr. Mudrin's termination. Again, as I mentioned before, he had been expressing a very negative attitude around the office. Instead of acting as he had before, friendly and helpful, he was staying in the office with his door closed, not smiling, not interacting with others, causing a lot of employees to ask if he was going to leave. He made inappropriate comments about Mr. Brown, calling him an effing Jew, made some other racist comments. There were rumors in the community.
And when were these reasons communicated to him? I mean, as I understand, originally the complaint was he wasn't a good enough producer.
Actually,
and later on, you came up with some of these other critiques, of which don't have anything directly to do with his being a producer.
The record actually supports that there never was one and only one reason given for Mr. Mudrin's termination. It's not a case that Brown & Brown adopted a reason, decided it wasn't good enough, and kept piling on the reasons. The only support, in fact, Mr. Mudrin testified that all anybody ever told him when he was terminated is, well, it's not going to work out. There was a very general reason on a couple of termination forms, just checking poor performance and failure to perform job duties. Mr. Wagner, who filled out those forms, testified that he understood the form to permit him to only check one reason. So he chose the reason that he thought was the most general and applicable reason. In addition to the reasons that I've already described, Mr. Manner heard rumors in the community about things that Mr. Mudrin was saying about Brown & Brown and working for Brown & Brown, namely that when Mr. Manner sold the agency, he kept all the money for himself and didn't take care of his workers. Mr. Manner found that offensive because he had given Mr. Mudrin $140,000 as a thank you for his helping him grow the business. The final, you know, another rumor in the community that was very serious is that, and this Mr. Mudrin admits saying this, he had stated that he might run an insurance agency through one of his children to get around the restrictive covenants in his Brown & Brown employment agreement. and that display of disloyalty was yet another reason that Manner and Wagner decided that he should be terminated.
Tell me this. Could a fact finder infer from the Colorado Springs correspondence that Brown and Brown was inclined to make termination decisions that were based on age?
No, and there are a couple of different problems with that particular piece of evidence. It was not authenticated. Nobody from Brown and Brown ever confirmed that it was what it purports to be. Brown and Brown moved to strike it on that basis, and although the judge didn't grant the motion, it was moot because he granted the motion for summary judgment. But that has absolutely nothing to do with what was going on in the Joliet Profit Center, because that, I believe, was a RIF situation in Colorado Springs. And in Joliet, it was a termination decision based on misconduct of an individual employee. And those kinds of decisions are made completely within each individual profit center by the managers locally and not by Brown and Brown as a whole. Moving on to the expert report, in order to qualify as an expert and be admissible, the report has to be relevant and reliable. The district judge did perform a Daubert analysis and concluded that it was not relevant because it grouped involuntary terminations and voluntary terminations, and it was not reliable for many reasons, including basic mathematical errors. Now, the district court serves a gatekeeping function in deciding whether to admit expert reports, and part of that is to ensure that experts employ the same intellectual rigor in their testimony as they do in the field. And I present that mathematical errors by a statistician doesn't satisfy the intellectual rigor.
What was the significance of the judge's comment that this report, since the expert was being paid to make the report, it must be biased report? Now, as I understand it, all these experts are paid to make their reports.
So I understood
what's the significance of that?
I understood the judge's point to be, because this report is filled with errors and because it purported to make statistical findings that didn't relate to the case, that it could only, the only explanation for a supposedly respected academic making a report like this was just for the money. And I'll give you an example of the kind of problems with the statistics. The expert report said that employees over 40 were terminated at a higher rate than those under 40. The problem with that analysis is that Dr. Moussa didn't consider the amount of employees at Brown & Brown who were over 40. So although it's true that 60% of the terminations or involuntary terminations were those of employees over 40, they also represented 60% of the workforce. So it's exactly the proportion that one would expect. And the point, I believe, of the judge was to disregard to make these statistical findings without regard of the actual pool of employees that one is examining. It could only be because one was being paid to make that conclusion.
Well, those are all points that you could make in cross-examining the expert, aren't they? You don't have to throw out the whole report because you feel it's made one error.
Well, it wasn't so much one error, Judge, but it was the error. It was the grouping of the voluntary and involuntary terminations and a number of other things that rendered the report neither relevant nor reliable. And our belief was that the best approach would be to ask the judge to strike it in its entirety. And the second report was simply untimely. And not only was the second report an attempt to cure the mathematical errors, but worse, it was far beyond the scope of the original report. It included 11 additional tables and different analysis as well.
Well, I think you have a better case on the untimeliness side than you do on the... I think that, you know, being critical of various outcomes that the expert makes may be grounds for cross-examination and so on. But I'm not sure whether it's grounds for throwing out the report entirely.
Well, under the abuse of discretion standard, which is what this court should apply to the judge's decision as to which of the factors, Daubert factors, to apply and whether or not to ultimately accept or reject the report, I certainly don't think that the judge abused his discretion. And that this court may have acted more leniently doesn't mean that the district judge acted unreasonably. I believe I'm out of time. Right?
You have 1 minute.
Okay. Well, I'll
portion thereof.
I'll conclude then. Going back to the termination, there's been an attempt to create or lay out a bunch of circumstantial evidence to point to age discrimination, but the fact of the matter is none of these circumstances actually point to Mr. Mudrin's age and the decision to terminate Mr. Mudrin. With respect to the expert report and the abuse of discretion standard that governs whether or not it should have been admitted, having mathematical errors in a statistician's report is certainly something that would reasonably cause a district court judge to believe that it's unreliable and to strike it on that basis. Thank you.
This was an error in addition, as I understand it, right?
Correct.
Thank you very much. Okay, Ms. Major.
May it please the court? I have 1 minute. I want to go over some of the facts that were presented that are disputed and give you some references to where you can find the information. In our brief, we quoted the whole text of Mr. Hyatt Brown's discussion about age. We didn't take anything out of context. We didn't misrepresent it. It's found in our brief at page 12. It's found in the record at Joint Appendix 547 to 548. What he says is that he hires people from public accounting firms into audit positions in order to bring them into sales, and that's the plan. He's got a lot of them, he says, kind of stacked up there. He's got too many there. He has to move them out. That's what his testimony was. As to personal lines, Mr. Mudrin testified that personal lines were supposed to be included in his sales production. That's found at JA 594 and JA 125. And in fact, as the testimony in this case has been, when we looked at Jungles, when we finally got documents in this case after motions to compel and all kinds of appeals to the Seventh Circuit, when we did get the documents, it showed, lo and behold, just as Mr. Mudrin had said, the personal lines were included in Jungles' reports, but not in Mr. Mudrin's. He thought it would be. That was his understanding. They did it with other people. They didn't do it with him. As far as his attitude is concerned, I'm sorry, is there a question?
No, you may just finish your thought.
Okay, as far as the attitude is concerned, he testified he didn't have a bad attitude. He had another person present an affidavit supporting that, Mr. Fitro. There's been no affidavits or evidence from anybody who's ever said that at Brown & Brown except the testimony of Manor and Wagner. All these purported people who have said these things, they've never presented evidence here. It's only been evidence by Mr. Mudrin to support his position that it's disputed. And those are things that need to go to the jury here. The wife's story as well, Joint Appendix 295, just ask you to read that because it's a lot different. He didn't admit to that as well. Thank you for your time. We do ask that Mr. Mudrin have his opportunity to present his case to a jury.
Thank you, Ms. Major. Thank you, Ms. Ramsey. The case will be taken under advisement.